Hi everyone, and welcome to Fraser's Capital Podcast. In this episode, we're going to do a slightly different format. This is a recording of a webinar I did on the 22nd of April, 2021. Hope you enjoy. Hi everyone, my name is Michael Fraser. I'm Portfolio Manager at Fraser's Capital Partners. Today, I'm going to go through some of the moves that have happened, you know, in markets. I'm going to talk about some specific stocks, and I'm going to answer some questions that were sent in. And you're very welcome to use the chat function to ask questions throughout this. I'll just run through us quickly. So kind of annualizing now over 30%. Median market capitalization of our companies is over 10 billion. And, you know, we've done this largely, we've generated these trends largely by investing in companies with exceptionally high organic growth rates. So across the portfolio, that's over 90%. It's actually over 100% now. The way our framework for looking at things is true love and explosive growth. We talked about these at length in previous webinars, so I won't go into them too much detail this time. But needless to say, the reason this is good is because it gives you the right answer as to which stock to buy. It's very different from all the different kinds of approaches, which generally give the wrong answers to the highest returning opportunities in the market over the last 10, 20 years, and certainly today as well. It's been pretty effective for us. We've obviously generated quite a few companies that have posted exceptional returns. There's another 4X here that's not actually on the spreadsheet. And this only includes companies that almost all of these we still own, actually. So it doesn't include ones that we've sold out of. Now, there's been a pretty steep sell-off in growth. I think it's important to put the last couple of months in context. So March last year was a huge shock. From April on, it was very apparent that people were spending huge amounts of money in things like e-commerce, digital health, and technology more broadly. And that triggered a huge rally in many companies that lasted certainly till the end of 2020 and then kind of ramped up from, you know, beginning of this year to the middle of February. I think that kind of period was almost a different phase. That was like a red hot phase. That's where markets were so thirsty for anything that looked like innovation that they're willing to invest in SPACs with no prospect of revenues, let alone profits in 5 years. Whenever you see these kinds of moments where huge amounts of capital are sucked out of capital markets and put into companies, like for example, the top of the tech bubble, you know, 20 odd years ago, there was a huge IPO boom. Capital went from the public markets into the hands of companies, and that very much marked the top. I think we definitely saw a bit of that in February, where there was just too much. You know, and if you're in the growth space, you know, buy these SPACs and the cash is going out. You know, you're not trading with another equity manager. You're trading with a company effectively, and they're not going to buy stock with the cash they got. They're going to use it. You really get this kind of like net outflow. It's like one of those parts of markets that are not zero sum. You know, if I'm trading with a fund manager, it is zero sum. If I'm trading with a company, it is not. And so it was also red hot in the sense that, you know, people were launching SPACs that before they announced a deal. So SPAC is just a cash shell effectively for a company. People were announcing SPACs at $10 a share. They're mainly trading up to, you know, 15 or 16 on the prospects of a good deal. And then deals were being done. And if it was exciting and really if there was a really good promoter behind it, some of them went up to $40, $50, $60. So you have a whole suite of investors. Another interesting part of this is a lot of people bought their first shares, you know, in March 2020 and kind of beyond that, and had the most charmed run you can imagine. You know, everything has just gone up. It's been great. Growth stocks have done better than tech indices, which have done far better than everybody else. This was the first stumble. And so it really kind of attracted that, the state of that market really attracted a lot of promoters and people who are really willing to make very strong claims about their companies. Another key feature of what happened is you're allowed to make forecasts. It's not that you're allowed. You're not allowed to make forecasts with SPACs. If you're an IPO, there's extensive due diligence done by the bank, believe it or not. And also there's very strict rules about what you can actually forecast. These kind of five-year projections, as in revenues that start in 5 years and go out for another 5 years, you just don't see that in public companies. Like if you think about the companies that you know that are listed, they'll put their results, but they won't put these long-term forecasts. There's good reason for that. And SEC is now cracking down on that pretty hard. And these companies have basically taken these forecasts off their websites and they deserve a lot of scrutiny. But I think just talking about this, just to show how red hot that moment was, how good the run was before that, and kind of it gives a good bit of context as to where we are now. So this chart that I've got here, actually I'll talk about the first one. So the first one is important at the top. Basically, it maps the 10-year growth rate versus your EV sales multiple change. So let's say, and this is kind of net of share issuance. So let's say a company grows at 30% and the ratio of the value of that company is to its revenues stays constant. Well, the company itself will return 30% over 10 years. If the multiple halves and it maintains 30%, that doesn't actually go down to 15%, it's 21%. So even if a multiple halves, so effectively a stock halves, but a company maintains 30% growth, there's a good chance you'll still get 21% a year. And that's quite relevant for us because, you know, our companies are growing at 100% plus, and in general, we're buying them with the prospect of multiple expansion. That's certainly what we look for. That's certainly what we're trying to do. You know, we want companies trading at 2, 3, 4 times sales, growing at 100% that can get to 10, 12, 15. And that's actually how we've got so many of these insane growths. Typically, the company's only doubled or tripled over this period, but we bought really well. And so I think now a lot of people are hearing about us for the first time, and they're seeing these companies at these exceptional rates after these moves. They've kind of this impression that what we do is we chase this stuff. We don't. We get in early when everybody's shorting it, short interest is sky high. Investment banks, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan writing negative bearish reports. That is a feature of almost of many of these companies on that list that have been our best performers. But that's a very different state to the market in February. In February, all these growth assets were being bid up to exceptional levels. It's just worth noting though that ultimately the growth wins. The longer the time frame, the more growth wins by. If you're trading day to day, companies, the fastest growing companies, the same today as it was yesterday. Next year, a company could be twice the size. Most of our companies, by definition, are more than twice the size they were last year. If you think about that over two, three, or four years, you can see how that's exceptional growth rate is far more relevant than a 20 or 30% move, which is interesting because everything just dropped 30%. So this is the bottom chart shows, I think it's about 15 of our companies, and the distance from 52-week high is on the right. So on average, our companies are 28% down from the 52-week high. Our portfolio is actually up year to date. So it's strange how these numbers kind of work. And in fact, if you look at these companies, they're on average, they're down 4%, but we're up, you know, more than that. So it kind of shows that you can actually outperform these things by, in our case, it was a couple of new positions that just did exceptionally well. And in February, we weren't actually buying at the top. We were actually net sellers in February and significant net buyers in March. An interesting thing here, though, is if you look at the EV sales across these companies, now EV sales is not applicable to all these companies. There's certain companies and situations where you can use it. For example, a software company growing at 90%, so EV sales is pretty close to gross profit. Some of these companies most definitely are not in that category. You know, Carvana at best will probably get 15% margins, for example. You know, the multiple from the end of 2020 to the end of 21 using analyst forecasts is down 34%. So it's a period where our fund has actually gone up, but multiples have contracted by 34%. It comes down to that growth rate and those different time periods. I think it's a really interesting display of why it is that we do what we're doing. I mean, we just survived a 28% fall in 52-week high from 52-week highs, 34% contraction, and the fund is up, you know, since 1 January. Should multiples drop another 34%, we'll probably be down, but that would be a pretty incredible buying opportunity. That'd be kind of where, you know, 2016, where software companies went up 10 to 20 times at the back end of that. I'd be surprised if we see that, because I think there's just a lot of people, you know, really looking for this stuff. And there are signs that things have actually bottomed now in this particular sell-off. Another interesting thing about this one was that it hit software. So software's had a pretty charmed run since the last 5 years. You know, multiple's been expanding the entire time. There were brief periods, you know, for example, in coronavirus, the software companies all sold off, but not more than the market. They rebounced faster. And there were sell-offs that these companies basically just sailed through unscathed. It's the first time you're actually seeing these big falls, and software's down 16% year to date. So I thought that was another interesting feature of this one. It's like sales multiples finally hit a point where they put in their high for this cycle. Now, I do not think sales multiples will get as high as that again in a very, very long time, like perhaps many cycles in the future. Like Snowflake's 133 times sales. It's pretty hard to make that work. Like let's say they double their revenues, okay, 50, 60 times sales. They double again, 30 times sales. They double again, 15 times sales. We're kind of underrating 3 years of 100% growth. If they double again, then maybe you'll make two times over 4 years. And if the multiple stays at 15, like it's just far too high. It doesn't, the kind of things that we do, the calculations we run to compare growth rates, multiple changes and the actual return to investors don't really apply to companies at 133. Like we could never make that work. Nevertheless, you know, those multiples are down 30%. They've gone from 44 times to 30 times. And if they got to 20 times, these companies would be exceptional buyers. The average growth rate for those is 50%. And, you know, on our ones, the selected one here is 88. So actually that's worth noting. So you've got multiples are contracted by a third, but these companies are still growing at 88%, these selected ones here. I've got some examples of SPACs. Now, this is one that we kind of owned. We bought around 23. It's now 17, but this kind of highlights that intensity of that rush into the market that we saw in Feb. Like these companies were just gapping up. And then that was kind of it. You know, everyone who was going to buy on high prices bought, and now they're just selling off. And then the sell-off was relentless. You know, it went from, I guess, you know, 12, 13 to 45 down to 12, 13 again. That's a big swing. That's a huge move. That's a lot of people losing money. And I guess at the moment there's been net money made, but you know, you'd have to think that most people who would have heard of this stock would have been drawn in at the top or bought, you know, in the first few dips. We actually own, as I mentioned, owned a little bit of this, and we bought a little bit more last night, actually. So it's nice to see it up 33%. It's a good start to the morning. They've also just confirmed their projection for 2021 that will be over 60% growth. Now, it's possible that when they report shortly that they don't hit that, but it'd be very strange for a company to post guidance above all analyst estimates and not beat that, especially in these internet companies that actually can see the data in real time. This is another way of looking at it. So in Jan 2020, the multiple was kind of 25, it rocketed to 40, and then, you know, went down to 12. Now it's about 15. The light blue line shows how fast this company is growing. So that's the revenue. So those of you who aren't familiar with these charts, and I've shown these quite a few times before, the light blue line here is for Shopify. So this is what we're trying to do across our entire portfolio. So we want these things growing. We want these things growing at this exceptional rate across the portfolio. This is obviously very early in its journey. And the reason for that is you get this exceptional performance in price if you can maintain that for 5 years. So Shopify was mostly 50, 60% growing. Skills is at 90 and affirming guidance over 60. This is another one I thought interesting. This is Teladoc. So you'd think Teladoc had like would do really well at the moment. But they've basically been flat on the year and actually down over this period. So this is leading digital health player. Again, huge run up in price and come down. This is the sort of thing that we think now, you know, post-February, post the floor, actually makes good buying. And so we're buying this as well. You know, it's kind of at the bottom of its range. It's done a transformational deal with Livongo, which is faster growing than Teladoc. And ultimately, you know, there was that hype into like all these coronavirus beneficiaries. Since February, there's been a huge pullback in all the coronavirus beneficiaries, but they're all winners. They're all structural long-term winners. And so there's a number of opportunities like this that we're trying to work on. You can see there the multiples back in middle of range, so it's kind of hard. It's kind of hard to use that on a company with a bunch of acquisitions. This is AppHarvest. So these people do something really cool. They basically grow plants in vertical farms. And it's kind of like, obviously there's that Malthusian idea that we'll run out of food, you know, 400 or 500 years ago, consistently proven wrong. And this kind of, if you think about like the 2D surface of the earth, and then you think about actually, well, you could just kind of grow in 3D and grow up. You can see there's almost limitless possibilities for growing food on this planet and limitless, you know, limitless ability to support population growth. A lot of people think population growth is a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. You know, for every extra million people, you know, you have a one in a million scientist, a one in a million artist, this growth in the world is good. There's also a lot of things that only happen at scale. So the level of scientific research, development, financial markets, the ability to fund new businesses, the larger you are, the more niche things can be filled, the more people there are to do these niche things, and the better we all are for it. That's just a random aside. But you often hear people thinking about, you know, I don't have kids because it's bad for the environment or something. You know, it's a very kind of misanthropic way of looking at the world, I think. And App Harvest is interesting. And this is also one of the SPACs. So you got $10, a couple of months later, $40, everybody kind of patting themselves on the back down to 14. Now, I like this company. I think they're very cool, but I don't think companies like this are really investable at the moment. I mean, huge CapEx, selling vegetables. It's probably not going to be very high margin. I certainly hope they succeed, and I'm sure they will, but it's not something you really want to kind of, it's not a particularly high return opportunity in my view. And there's a ton of these things. So, there's flying car companies that I can't talk about. There's multiple battery companies. This is one that got a lot of people's attention. So it ripped up from, I guess, $10 to $120. It's 12 times in 2 months. Like, that gets a lot of people's attention. It's now dropped from 120. What was the high? 125, maybe. 132 down to 33. So it's lost 3/4 of its value in the last few months. They don't have anything. They have some technology for a battery, but there's a huge, huge gap between a functional prototype, a tiny scale in a lab, and commercial production. I actually did my master's thesis in this at Oxford. This is like the battery that we use. We put gas into it as a hydrogen fuel cell, and there are enzymes on the two black rectangles on the right and left. And basically, I spent the whole year trying to figure out how to get it from something that was the size of the end of a pencil to something that was kind of like, I guess, 2x4 centimeters. That took a year, and I'm not trying to make any kind of equivalence between this and that. But I do know that things that work at small scale in batteries don't necessarily work at large scale. So think about lithium ion batteries and how much development has gone into that. They're actually discovered or kind of, what's the right word, invented in the same lab. But think of all the problems they had with like catching fire and how difficult it was to get it, them all working together. But there's two parts. There's like the scientific theory around batteries, and there's many different approaches that could work and be better than the current. Then there's the engineering. Then there's like the heat dissipation, the manufacturing engineering, getting them to think of all the power you need to drive a car. That's a lot of power. That's potentially dangerous. There's so many things that a small pouch battery is just so far from solving all those problems. And this is one of those companies with very aggressive forecasts of when they'll do, heavily promoted. I don't think there's like an easy way out. Like I don't think this is going to bounce. I don't think this is going to come back the way I think that other companies that have sold off equivalently are going to bounce. And there's a lot of these. So a lot of wealth will be kind of lost, I think, by people who invest in these kinds of companies. Got some questions. So somebody asked, well, do we still own Dermtech? We do. I think if you invest in a company like Dermtech, has to be for the long term. There's no other way. You cannot look at the price and worry about it. I mean, it's probably trading about where we bought it, a little bit higher. But you know, it's one of those ones that went from 10 to 80, now to 40. Look, they've done two things. They've got something that the clinicians like, and they've also got something the payers like, and they haven't even started their rollout really. So for this to really perform, it's going to have to, it'll be years before they get proper revenues at scale. But they have de-risked it in a pretty significant way. So this is a very high quality life sciences asset, in my opinion. So we're holding. But remember, we own 50 stocks. So I don't like doing stock recommendations, because something that might make sense for us at a 0.9% position, which at the right time we can add to. But really, there's the risk of loss. The volatility that adds to our portfolio is really low. My guess is if people are writing in asking about this question, it's probably a much higher portion of their portfolio, much more meaningful. The answer is different. You know, we wouldn't put 5 or 10% of our fund and our money into this now at these prices, or at this level of development. So keep that in mind. We asked about Chinese regulatory risk, and I wrote about it in our update. So do we have concerns that the Chinese Communist Party might clip the wings of major tech companies? The answer is not really, because it's an amazing structure. So you don't, if you buy Alibaba, you don't actually own any Alibaba shares. You own variable interest entity based, it's basically a chain of contracts between a company owned in China and the listed stock. Now, the Chinese could cut that at any moment, and they've never approved that structure of which billions and billions of dollars have been raised. But the reason they wouldn't do it, in my opinion, is it's just so lucrative for them. Like, they raise US dollars in the US, the US dollars flow back to China and stay there. You know, Alibaba doesn't pay a dividend. None of these companies really pay dividends. The flow of money is one way. And China has the power inside the country to do whatever they want with those companies. Those companies have to do what the Chinese Communist Party wants. And you can see, you know, Jack Ma perhaps got a little bit outspoken and has barely been seen since. You know, they have full control. It's very different from an equity where, you know, there's mechanisms through which, you know, a group of shareholders could take control of a US company or a foreign company with a more conventional US share structure. There's basically no way that you could do a hostile takeover of Alibaba in the United States and, you know, change how things were being done in China if the Chinese didn't want that to happen. So they have full control and they're getting a huge amount of money. And were they to play around with this structure, they would lose that. And so I don't know. I think the scenario in which they would do that is extremely narrow. I mean, you're more likely to see conflict, I think, before they'd cut off the dollars. And then there's more risk on the other side, which is, or there's also risk on the other side. The Americans say, the Americans could say, look, you can't list here anymore. In which case, these companies would very quickly delist to Hong Kong, which is increasingly Chinese, or even Shanghai. So I don't think there'll be destruction of wealth there. But ultimately, the Americans care about money as well. So they wouldn't want to do that harm. They want that trading volume there. They want that on their exchanges. The shareholders include a lot of Americans. Really don't lose too much sleep over this Chinese regulatory risk issue. And broadly, that's proven true. Like, there are some discounts for Chinese stocks relative to Western counterparts. Often that's because the Western counterparts are trading extremely high. But broadly, the market is just going on as though these were stocks the same way as any other one. And you could take this whole argument a step further, you know, and say, you know, what is a stock? You know, it's very abstract. What do you own? Like, do you have any real ownership? Can you really make that many changes? Does the CEO own it? You know, does the doorman own it? There's really good articles by Matt Levine that really unpack like who owns what. And you realize it's basically just an idea. The whole thing's entirely abstract. You can either get lost in that and say nothing's real, or you can say, look, it's an idea, but, you know, a company is something that unifies, you know, a whole bunch of people do certain things. And one share is an abstract partial ownership of that. You have to be very comfortable in those kinds of levels of abstraction. But I think that's just the human race. We're actually pretty good at this kind of stuff. So I don't recommend getting too lost in the weeds on this kind of stuff, because occasionally there are incredible opportunities in coming out of China. When you underwrite potential investments, you focus on customer level massive growth, but do you focus on paths to profitability? And there's a few more questions around that. The answer is yes, but I'm going to caveat that by saying a lot of people, most of our companies are more profitable than people think. So Tesla, for example, has been profitable for very long. And I tell people this in meetings, sophisticated allocators who probably have backed a lot of companies shorting Tesla, you don't seem to know this. So a couple of years ago, this was trading 15 times EBITDA, especially a value stock, 15 times EBITDA for Tesla. That was before the huge rip in share price. And again, in the industry, it seems like nobody really knows this or really wants to engage with the fact this company's been profitable for a long time. Another one was Afterpay. You know, it was profitable in, when did we buy it? 2016. It was profitable then. Huge cash draw, but it was profitable. What we want to see these companies investing all that profit. This is an example we use because it's so topical, it's Xero. And without going into it too much, because we've gone into so much before, you know, between 2015 and 2016, it lost more money. But it was over a period where revenues grew from 124 to 200. So 200 million. So that's like explosive growth in annual recurring revenue, very sticky, very high margin, extremely low price sensitivity. And that was kind of effectively, if anything, a buy signal. You know, the stock went from $20 to peaked at 160. So it's eightfold return in 6 years. And obviously it's off a little bit now, but not much. So that's kind of what we look for. Square's another example, which is helpful because they made, most of these companies are very cagey about cohort analysis. They don't want to really tell you their cohorts. If you really kind of model them out, you can figure it out just by the change in certain, you can almost figure it out by the change in annual recurring revenue and in subscribers and things like that. It's not perfect, but you can get a pretty good idea. In this case, they've broken it out. So in Q1 2015, they spent 32 mil and got 172 million back in gross profit. So you're answering the question, do we look for profitability? It's like, no, not really. But we look for companies that can invest 32 million of profit and get 172 million back. Now, technically, if they spent that 172 on getting, you know, 580 back or 600 back or whatever it is, they would still not be making money because they'd be spending that on sales and marketing, which is accounted as a cost. But that is what we look for. This is the dynamic that we look for. I wouldn't get lost in, do we look at care about profitability? Of course we do. But it's beside the point. We want to see this. These dynamics in action. There was another part of that question. Growth in revenues, users, or both? Look, we try and identify the key KPIs, you know, which typically is users, revenue per user, revenues, gross profit, and then how much are they spending on the various items. We actually do a lot of work on these things and model out all those costs and figure out the return on all those. If they're spending this much on the business, if this is their entire OPEX line, what's the return on that? How much is annual recurring revenue increase? We'll also break it down. Okay, if you just take the sales and marketing, what does the picture look like? We do a lot of work around that stuff. But in general, if the key KPIs are being good, but you have an opinion that the stock is bad, generally the key KPIs win. It comes back to that customer love point. You know, the customers win, beat the investors every time. Let's see if there's any questions here. Looks like there's two. What's my mouse? You mentioned if you see a drop, it'll represent a great buy, but you think it's hit bottom or close. Do you have cash reserves? Are you buying at the moment? Yeah, I mean, we sold a couple of things and we did actually have cash going into this. So we've been net buyers. I think last night, I think things have been bottoming for a while. You know, so I'd say software has bottomed. Teladoc looks like it bottomed. Companies like that. I think some of the dodgier SPACs, or not the dodgier ones, the more promoty SPACs, the ones that have promoters out them, pumping them up, I think they could continue going down for, you know, a year. But I do think you've got to take your opportunities when they come. And for us, that was, you know, in the last few weeks. It's not often that things drop 30%. Could they drop more? Yeah, of course they could. But another important dynamic that's giving us comfort is there's no doubt that everything is firing. You know, prices are rising across the board. Economies are firing. Employment is dropping. The recovery hasn't even come in full swing yet. There's downsides to that. There's inflationary risks. There's the consequence of that on growth multiples. But broadly, you know, companies performing exceptionally well. And so when you have companies performing exceptionally well down 30%, you can't hesitate. You have to invest. Do you have any opinion on ACTC? I don't know what ACTC is. I'm going to quickly Google it. Arclight Clean Transition Corp. Sorry, I will have to look about it. Tim Stark, what do you think of the Redbubble quarterly this morning? I actually just glanced at it as I started this thing. Look, it seems solid. It seemed in line. I think Redbubble is a COVID beneficiary. So those companies are all going to be under pressure across the board, but they're still executing. They're still growing. It's a two-sided marketplace. I think with those companies, when did we get in? We would have got in around $3 and I think it's about $5 now. And probably peaked at $6. I think now you're either in these companies for the long term, or if you're more of a fast term, follow the money trader kind of person, maybe now's the time you just flick all of those and go into travel stocks and airlines and things like that. That's not really what we do. We will stay in this one for the long term. But again, keep in mind, this is probably a 2.5 position for us. Usually there's a lot more questions. Chat, oh, they're in chat. Will recording be sent out after? Yes. Michael, I wonder if you saw the Bernstein note on Afghan $40 price target. I have not read that note. If Afghan was going to $40, you know, they just reported and they maintained over 100% growth again. You know, this has been four times a year for the last 5 years for us, watching Afterpay post quarterly results over 100%. You could see the multiple contract. Sure. What's their multiple trading at? Yeah, I think over time, the multiple will halve and potentially even halve again. You know, if I had to guess, if that happened all at once, the stock would drop 75%. But it's not you know, it's happening slowly and the company itself is growing at 100%. So you're weighing off those two things. I think price targets in a company like that are kind of nonsense anyway. It's really the wrong way to look at it. It'll get you the wrong answer. You'll do the wrong thing. Thoughts on Airtasker? I think it's a great company. I think we pass on it because the growth isn't high enough. It's not to say it's not going to accelerate and it's not going to do really well. I think it will generate positive returns over time, probably better than most stocks. But it's not, when we looked at it, the growth rate wasn't high enough for us. So our growth rate actually across the portfolio is around 110% now. And we make various adjustments to that to get some approximation for organic, but it's well over 100. So we're really looking at companies, you know, in that category. They're rare, they're hard to find, but they can really move when they get going. What was the most recent new company addition we made? Look, I'll tell you what we were buying. We bought a lot in the last week. There's a company called Futu that I think is possibly our best play at the moment. They've got, you know, over 10 million, I think 14 million. It's basically an online brokerage, but with a community around it in China. So there's a few layers there. They've got maybe 14 million users, maybe more, maybe less. I think they posted the last update, they said 14 million. In their last results, they had around 400,000 paying customers. So think about the size of China, think about a 14 million community, and then think like a few hundred thousand people paying. You can see the opportunity there. And their growth was 270% organic with very high margins. They just sold off a lot in the last couple of days because share price got to 160 and they had a cap raise at 130. So obviously it's free money. It was a large cap raise. It was almost $2 billion. So they probably did have to do some discount, but that's $2 billion at 130. The share price is 160. Obviously everybody that got that those shares at 130 just sold them in the market and flicked it for medium profit. And the share price went, 160 down to 130. But those who were fast had plenty of time to kind of lock in effectively a risk-free profit. So that's a recent one. Q&A. Thoughts on Coinbase? Look, we really like Coinbase. It's not trading as expensive as you think. Let me try and dig it up. It would be less than 20 times. I think it was 17 times sales. Coinbase is the most trusted counterparty. I'd say this time cryptocurrency is heading mainstream. Every professional investor is thinking about it. I'd say most people are thinking about it. If you've got real money, and like I know this feeling, if you've got other people's money, you want to make sure your custody is rock solid. And I don't think any of the exchanges other than Coinbase really offer that. You want to go to the best. You know, it's really one of those cases where number one has huge benefits and being known as the best custodian and being insured and being properly regulated and having done that the entire way puts Coinbase in a really strong position for all those institutional flows, like a brokerage, and they charge so much. You know, it's extremely profitable business. They benefit from flows and volumes as much as they certainly benefit from the price increase as well, because that increases the volumes in US dollar terms anyway. So I think it's probably the best, most stable way of playing cryptocurrency that gives you multiple ways to win. And it's off maybe, I guess, a third from where it peaked in the IPO. So it's not at that hyper exuberant level. But it's a tough one. I mean, I don't make recommendations. I think with something like Coinbase, it's something you buy a little bit, You just slowly build up position with time, because I don't think it's going to, I think the big move was over the last couple of years and certainly the last 12 months. I think that was the big move. So that's not going to happen again. It might, if Coinbase trades sideways down for a year, it could wind up for another big explosive movement. But I don't think you'll get a quick buck there, but it's a very good long-term investment, I think. The Chinese broker was called Futu, F-U-T-U. Please don't go and put all your life savings in, even though I think it is one of the better things we own. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. Maybe we'll wrap up there. What was my last slide? Yeah, so to kind of summarize, you know, economies are firing, prices are rising. We're in extremely high quality companies. They're growing exceptionally well. There's been a huge sell-off in growth, big rotation. Everyone's talking about it. We're kind of just back where we were a few months ago, still positive for the year. kind of shows the resilience of this stuff. I don't want to overdo resilience too much because we're basically fully invested at almost all times. So you do move with the market. But it really shows if you're in high quality, you can perform better than you'd expect in these kinds of environments. There's huge opportunities. So all the SPACs have been killed, from skills to things like Matterport. They're the kind of high quality ones, we think, to the ones that are pure promotionary schemes, you know, or just extremely speculative, like a flying car that might be there in 5 years' time, like the first production car in 5 years' time. There's a number of those companies. There's a number of battery companies with no real tech. And you know what? Only one of them can win, you know, including lithium. Only one of them can kind of capture the market. Actually, one more point on batteries. There's kind of a trade-off. There's trade-offs in batteries. The trade-off isn't should we get lithium to some ultra-fast charging, amazing battery? There's other ones. It's cost and reliability and safety. And the Chinese, for example, aren't using lithium. They're using iron-based batteries, which are far, far cheaper. And then it's a completely different way of doing it. You're kind of swapping batteries in and out. So it kind of encourages swapping infrastructure rather than charging infrastructure. But really, I think they've got it right. And I think Apple got it right as well when they said, you know what, people are going to charge these things every day most of the time. So I don't think you actually need that range that people stress out about. You know, I think most people with these cars will plug them in once a day at home. So I think the trade-off is less, it's more about cost, reliability, all those engineering issues, how cheaply can you manufacture it, how safe is it? They're all the things that go into it. Whereas when I read these SPAC new battery things, obviously I have huge skepticism because I know how hard it is to go from there to commercial production. I also know that you're racing a moving train. So lithium batteries and all these other batteries in the market now are also improving at a very rapid rate. So if your battery is coming online in 5 years, you're not competing against lithium batteries today. You're competing against lithium batteries in 5 years' time. All that together, even if you think of, you know, all that stuff, I don't see any kind of acknowledgement in these SPAC presentations of those engineering issues like safety, manufacturing, reliability. You know, they're more focused on these headline academic improvements in efficiency and charging rate and things like that, which are very easy to do in a lab on a small scale and extremely difficult at larger scale. Let's wrap up there. Thanks for joining. And shoot through any questions you have via email and I'll answer them next time. I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.